and welcome all. Step right up, step right up, ladies and gentlemen. Portal Gaming Podcast, episode number 178 is coming at you right now. Howdy, everybody. Portal Game Podcast, a product of the store called The Portal, which is located in Manchester, Connecticut. For more information, you can go to www.theportalct.com. Check us out on Facebook, The Portal, on Twitter, at PortalGaming60, and on YouTube. You can find our streaming, unboxing, and other things channel, Step Into The Portal. That's mostly where you will find my face to go with this voice that you're listening to on the podcast. Howdy, everybody. My name is The Brant. You are listening to episode 178 of The Portal Game Podcast, which is a proud member of the Dice Tower Network. And for more awesome podcasts, you can go to www.dicetowernetwork.com. I am not alone today. I am tired of doing podcasts by myself. I am joined by a fellow Connecticut resident and publisher of Smirk and Dagger and Smirk and Laughter Games, Kurt Covert. Kurt, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Brant.
No problem. Thanks for joining me here in our snowy and soon to be cold New England. But I don't know, in winter, I wouldn't have it any other way.
Exactly right. That's why we live here, I guess.
Yeah, it's great. So, yeah, thanks for joining me. Thanks for doing the podcast here. I had a whole full day of teaching, but I'm keeping the energy up here going into this. Happy New Year, too. Happy 2022.
Thank you. Yeah. Here's hoping that we get even a little bit closer to normal and we can start seeing each other a little bit more often and playing more games. I'm looking forward to convention season and hope that we have as successful one as we did last year even. So
yeah, we'll talk about some of the conventions in 2021. That's kind of our topic for the day, so we'll chat about those things at the end. Also got to see you at an event over at the store because you came over for our Extra Life game day. And that was really fun. It wasn't as highly attended as it normally is, obviously given COVID, but it was still good to get to sit down and play some games, play some of your games, play some other games together, and just have an event with people in the store, which kind of fit right between Delta and Omicron nicely. That
yes,
it worked out. So thanks for coming over to that. Why don't you tell people just a little bit about about Smirk and Dagger, Smirk and Laughter, and some of the games that you publish?
Oh, sure. Well, so Smirk and Dagger has been a passion of mine for the past 18 years. I started in 2003 with a title called Hex Hex. And I think it's safe to say that for 14 years, I specialized very heavily in Take That games, hence Smirk and Dagger. I did so because I love highly interactive game experience. I love high emotion at the table. I love, people shaking their fist and cursing your name and the Schadenfreude and all of that great stuff that happens during Take That games. And so I dedicated my company to it. But about 4, maybe 5 years ago now, I ended up making a shift to full time. And when I did that, I ended up creating the sub-brand Smirk and Laughter because I realized that I was serving a niche and not everyone loves Take That games as much as I do. And in order to really, sustain myself full time, I would have to appeal to all gamer audiences. So I added a whole line of really other interesting games that all kind of still tap into like this kind of emotional space. I like games that still impact you in some way emotionally, either, through the narrative or just the energy of the game. Now I've got 18 years behind me and looking forward to the next 18, I guess.
There you go. Funny enough, my first run-in with you was not in Connecticut. It was in Indianapolis. I believe it was the first Gen Con I attended, which I want to say was 2015, maybe 2014. I'm not sure. But we were not playing a high interactive loud game. I think we were playing Champions of Midgard, and you were getting ready for Run for Your Life, Candyman. Is that what it is?
Yep.
And you warned us. You came over and you're like, gentlemen, just so you know, you're welcome to sit here, but it is about to get as loud as possible. We were like, oh, no problem. We can concentrate. And it was hard to concentrate, for sure. You were not kidding. And no. I think that's the first time that I had been made aware of Smirk and Dagger.
Well, I tell you what.
Specifically.
That particular event, every year, it is the biggest event we run all year. It's at Gen Con. It's close to midnight Saturday night. And it's of, you know, if people don't know Run for Your Life Candyman, it's almost barely a game. Right. It was never intended to be published. It was supposed to be just a joke that I published on the internet, and you could download it and play it with your own Candyland, because it's like this twisted version of Candyland where you're trying to escape the land and you're going to do anything you can, including tearing the limbs off other cookies as you're heading out. It's ridiculous. It's hysterical. And now there's kind of like this little cult following around it. Where, you know, it gets loud, it gets boisterous. There are chants that go back and forth. You know, very often if you lose your head, it's now customary that the person who claimed it stands on top of their chair and says, "Behold the head of my enemy," to which all 96 other players shout, "Hurroo!" It's crazy.
That's awesome. Yeah, you know, I definitely consider myself an Omni gamer. My daughter is now 12. She used to be on the podcast when she was 5 and 6, reviewing kids' games and things like that with me to really round out the Omni gamer, you know, element of everything. But, you know, there was definitely a tendency towards some of the higher level strategy games that I had, even though kind of playing everything. But I tell you, I forget. Sometimes, or it's easy to forget when you get caught in some of the bigger strategy games, this like the joy of 30 to 45 minutes around a table, just laughing, just picking on each other, you know, with the right group of people. And yeah. I've really, to me, take that games work so well when they're like under that 45 minute time frame. Most recently, you taught me Deadlies. And I'm telling you, I brought a bunch of big name, you know, for our hobby game party games to Thanksgiving and Christmas, and they didn't go over nearly as well as Deadlies. So, you know, I just, some of the word games and things that have been so popular, it's just, it's so low energy with those, even though they're great games, that just the energy of some of these take that games really does bring that out. And when everybody's at the table and they don't actually really, you know, winning and losing is just part of the experience, not the goal.
Right.
It it really brings that. So thank you for introducing that game to me. I mean, also publishing it, but it's real. I'm not lying. You can go back about 3 episodes. I reviewed it, and it's just been so much fun ever since you came to that Extra Life game day. I've had that in my bag everywhere I go. So
yeah, a great game by Paul Saxberg, who actually works over at Roxley Games, and he came up with the design. He pitched it internally. They really loved the game, but they're like, "Paul, this is not really quite what we do, man. I'm not quite sure what to do with." And so he said, "Hey, listen, I wouldn't trust a lot of people with my game, but if you were interested in this, I would want to work with you on it." And so we did, and we worked together. We put some of the cards in the final form, and it just delivers all that great all that great poke you in the eye fun that that so many of my games do.
Yeah, no, it was great. And then of course Shobu just a couple years back was also just a gem, just a standout abstract. The look, the rocks, the rope, just giving it that kind of classic, what would you call that? Classic feel? I hate to say ancient feel. That seems too old.
It is.
Top.
Yeah. It feels like an ancient abstract. I always say to people that the game that Manu and Jamie delivered was something that feels like they discovered the game, not invented it.
Right.
And It is a pure, pure abstract. It's very thinky. It's so like the back of the box has the entire rule set. But when you get into playing, it's got this great curve where it's easy to start. And then halfway through the game, it turns into 3-dimensional chess and your brain melts. And so it's a wonderful abstract. And to your point, like it feels ancient, and I think that's in the end what made me give myself permission to actually publish it, because as I said, I really like games that kind of connect with people emotionally, and like this, it's a pure abstract.
Yeah,
but I think because when you sit down to play it, you you don't really feel, you are transported to the time where this game feels like it was created.
Right.
And so there, you do get a real sense from the game. And I think that's what I really loved about it. But I struggled. I was like, this is not what I do. I don't do abstracts. It's not like a super emotional hit. It's just, it's different, but it's beautiful. I love it. And why can't I make a pretty thing?
Yeah, I mean, we've had it out. I can imagine the same for you at conventions, but like just having it out at the store and just kind of having it there, and people will just, they'll look at it. You can go over and be like, oh, you just do this. And oh, okay. And, you know, kids with their mom, they'll start playing it. Two grown-ups come in, they just start playing it. Like it's just asking you to play it, you know, like you just look at it and you're like, oh, how does this work? I must know how this worked, because I've played abstract games, right? I played checkers or chess or something or whatever it is. It just looks like something I should know how to play.
Yeah. And quite honestly, it's so beautiful that a lot of people actually just leave it out as part of their home decor. But you're right. It's something that just begs to be touched. I think the cotton rope that divides the boards is a memorable item. People have come into other stores and said, you know, hey, do you have that game with the rope? The retailer's like, yep, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Nice. Awesome. All right, well, we'll talk a little bit about games here. I'm going to review a game, and then you can tell us maybe about some games that you've been playing recently. Sure. And then we can run through. I've got some pictures of some of your other games. I got a chance to play Night Cage once on my own this past weekend. And I'd also love to hear about The Spill, which is upcoming. So that's kind of our plan of attack here. Sound good?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So the only game I'm going to review this episode, it's a biggie though, is called Ark Nova. And this is from Pureland Spiel and being published in North America by Capstone Games. Capstone tends to be the booth that I work at a lot of the conventions, so I know them well over there. So Ark Nova is a game about building a zoo. So the Ark kind of goes with animals and Nova meaning new. So it's kind of like a new Ark, new zoo, new start. And so you all have your own zoo that you're building, and you're generally competing. There's two different things that you're trying to score. You're trying to score appeal, which is basically like ticket sales, like people wanting to come to the park, as well as conservation. So you're trying to keep the animals alive. You're trying to take house, home animals, that might be endangered or need a specific habitat or whatever that is, as well as work on various conservation projects. Everybody has their own player board in front of them. There's one side of the player boards, which is the same, and you can flip them over and they're all asymmetric. And you're going to build out your enclosures and your kiosks and your pavilions and other buildings. You have a reptile house and a bird aviary that you can build along that hexagonal, those hexagonal spaces. So for the end of the game, the way the end of the game is going to trigger is the appeal is running one way around the board and the conservation is running the other way around the board. And kind of like Rajas of the Ganges, when the two cross, you trigger the end of the game. So that's what you're trying to do in Ark Nova, is get those two to cross. The way the game works is everybody has five action cards below their player board, and they're kind of in order 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You pick one, you kind of slide it down and say, I want to do this action. When you pick to do that action, you do it at whatever number level it's at. So if I was going to do the, add animals to my park at level 4, the card would say, oh, at level 4, you can add one animal type to your park. Once you do that, you will then slide it to the end and everything else slides up. So it's got that action mechanism, which was also made popular in a new civilization from Fantasy Flight Games, that same action was there. And then you got your hand of cards a la Terraforming Mars, Underwater Cities, all those types of games. And you're playing the cards. You've got sponsors. You've got conservation projects that you can do by achieving certain goals. And you've got your animals that you can add to your zoo. It is a big, long, grandiose game. So you definitely have to be prepared for 2 to 3 hours. Which is a lot, but I feel like with a lot of card draw, there's the center where you can grab the cards from and they all slide down and all that kind of stuff, where you're kind of drafting cards and you're just drawing cards off the top. because of the length of the game, not only can you enact what you're trying to do well, because you won't necessarily say, oh, I never drew that card, or I never saw one of those cards. You might see a limited number, but there's a pretty long length to the game. So it's not like this 20 minute, I better draw what I need or else. And the game forces you to pivot, which is one of the things I love. Like, this isn't working. I need to go in a different direction now. That's what the game is telling me to do. And you need to try to do that. Anyway, all that being said, I absolutely adore the game. We managed to get a copy in from Europe before its release, which I think should be in February in North America. So I got a chance to play it several times. I did a solo playthrough on the channel for people who want to see it. You can go to Step Into the Portal and see the solo playthrough of the game there. And I absolutely adore it. And I got plays in just before the end of 2021. So even though I had made my top 10 list, it jumped right to the top of my top 10 list. It is my number one game of 2021. I really, really like it. There's going to be a lot of comparisons to those other games, Underwater Cities, Terraforming Mars. I mean, thematically, it's very different. It's somewhat non-interactive. There's more positive interaction than negative interaction. So, like, I can play cards that say anytime anybody adds a primate to their zoo, I get a bonus, as opposed to I'm going to prevent you from being able to add primates to your zoo, or I'm going to eliminate a primate in your zoo, which is a terrible idea. We would not want that to be in the game. But yeah, it's just one of those. I feel like it might, like Terraforming Mars did, like Wingspan, I feel like it's going to be popular, even though it is long and even though it is, you know, higher on the strategy end. I think people are just going to kind of be in for the ride, even though it goes past that. So anyway, that's the one game I really wanted to talk about. I would straight out give it a 10 out of 10. I just think it'll probably be one of my favorite games of all time. And I have played it 2 solo, 2 4-player, and a 2-player game. So 5 times. So I've definitely played it a lot. And even the 4-player games aren't bad because the actions are really quick. It's generally one of those games. Now, I do have a group that is not prone to AP. I wouldn't say we're fast, like lightning fast, but I would say we're not prone to AP. So if you tend to have a group with 4 players and 2 of them are going to really slow things down, that could really start to push to a length that could be, you know, uncomfortable for some people. But my groups, pretty much all of them, I'd say the 2-player game was right around 2 hours. And the 4-player games have been right around 3 hours. So,
wow. Yeah, I'd actually like to try that with you sometime.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's good. It's hard to say, too, when everybody's looking down, right, and they're not overly worried about everything everybody else is doing. Why is that? Like, what's good about that, right? It's hard to say, but it's like, well, I think it's just my brain versus the cards versus what's out there versus the possibilities, because it's really an efficiency game. Right? Who can do this the fastest? And so my timer is the other players. So that's where our interaction with it's, you know, at a meta level instead of at a direct level.
I think, you know, those tend to be some of the most popular games in the industry. I think there are a lot of gamers who actually really value being able to, like, you know, build their engines, look for optimization, do their turns the way they want to do them, and actually kind of like a slightly more siloed play style,
right?
Where, you know, I think you said it very well. Like, you know, the other players are your timer, you know, or they're what you're measuring yourself against, but you're still really trying to accomplish your own goals.
Sure. I mean, it's the shot put versus baseball, right? Or football. Football is like, I'm going to push against you and you're going to push against me and we'll see who's stronger and then we'll do it again and do it again and do it again. But shot put is, we're individually going to throw and I do well if I do better than everybody there, right?
Yeah, exactly right.
So it's that different piece. But anyway, that is Ark Nova. So I'm really excited for the release of that game. I hope people enjoy it as much as I have. And I don't lead people astray, but I really think people should go out and play it. I think they'll really enjoy it. And there's certainly gamers who will know that's not going to be my type of game. I'm just not in for 2 and 3 hours, right? So what have you been playing lately, Kurt?
Well, so obviously I always play a lot of my prototypes or games that we're working on, but outside of my own sphere, let's see, I picked up Lost Ruins of Arnak during the convention season, so I've been enjoying that one. Which, you know, it's kind of a fun, you know, resource building, you know, ladder climbing game. But it takes place thematically in this jungle, and you're trying to discover the temple, and it's a very cool game. And I have an absolute love for Renegade's Clank series.
Okay.
So I think I played two or three of those recently, and we've been playing a lot of the expansions. We absolutely love the adventuring party where all the characters or players are asymmetric. And so, you know, whether you're playing Mr. Whiskers, who is trying to sneak through the dungeon, but make a lot of noise for other players, and get the dragon to attack them, or some of the other characters, there's just something really charming about it. As well as we just tried, this is the first time I actually got it to the table, The Curse of the Monkey Lord, which has this double-sided board where you can actually campaign play it. You can play one side of the board to kind of like, you know, get score and resources, and then you flip it over, you do round two, and now you're in the temple. And what's cool about the temple board is it's got these rotating gears that activate at different times during the game. So passageways you were counting on may disappear, and which is a lot of fun. Because again, it's a push your luck style game where you're trying to delve as deep as you can, get as much treasure, and then get out before everybody dies. Here, you know, someone might decide they're going to make a quick run, grab a bunch of stuff, and then doom you all by being out quickly.
That is my preferred in the game.
There's always somebody. And I tend to be the one who's like, no, you know what? I'm going to see whether I can at least get to the surface with more stuff than you got. But in any case, yeah. So, and I think we even played a couple Quacks of Quedlinburg. I ended up getting those deluxe pieces from the Board Game Geek, the deluxe packs things. Oh, it's so satisfying digging into the bag and get those plastic spell ingredients. So anyway, yeah, bunch of stuff.
That's awesome. Yeah, Clank is what I'm ready to go back to. So Brian, the owner of the portal, he had lived with us. He and his family would live with us. They were trying to purchase a house, and the pandemic hit.
Yeah.
So they were kind of in that in-between, and so they were with us through that. So at one point, we just broke out Clank Legacy, just the two of us, and just boom, boom, we just threw it down. It was like two or three games a night, you know, just trying to get through it. That's how I like to play Legacy games the best, is just generally with one other person. And like, we're going to do it. We're not going to just say we're going to do it. Like, we're here, we're going to get through it. So my wife has done a lot of those with me, as well. But it definitely was like, I enjoyed the experience, but it definitely was like, I'm good with Clank for a little while, but now, you know, it's been that year and a half, 2 years, and it really is a great game. So I was actually just writing down the ones you were saying to remind myself, yeah, I got to go back and play that again. And I imagine that's something my daughter would really enjoy. So I want to try that with her. I think she would like Clank with the adventuring party and all those. And she loves Quacks of Quedlinburg. In fact, I think on our channel, that is the only live play she's done with me is Quacks of Quedlinburg.
Oh, fun. Yeah.
And I don't have those geek up bits. I think the Quacks of Quedlinburg are probably like the most famous or most sought after geek up bits that I can think of. They have
a lot of them.
They're pretty sweet. I feel like that's one with reaching into the bag. And it never really bothered me. And it was actually, I was always fine with it. But it was when I got Warp's Edge, which is another Renegade game. It's a solo game. And I got it with the Kickstarter tokens that you can draw out of the bag. And it's really amazing in that. Like, I feel that, oh, wow, when I draw things, it's exciting to draw some out of the bag. And now I've wanted to go get the geek up bits.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other day, Brian told me that he actually ordered them for his Quacks of Quedlinburg. So I may borrow his copy just to try them out and see how it goes. They are pretty awesome. I'm not huge into blinging out my games. I think I'm more of I have a breadth rather than a depth in my collection. I'm more of I got a lot. What do you want to play?
Yeah. And I tend to be that way too. But when I saw those, just, you know, because it's a blind bag draw where, you know, you have that tactile sense. It makes it worth it.
Nice. All right. So let's talk about some of your games. I'm going to try to share my screen here.
Uh-oh, technology.
There we go. And so we've got some pictures here that you sent over. So this looks like your team here. Can you see my screen?
I can indeed. Yeah. Okay. So this is, where is it? Is this? This might be PAX Unplugged, actually.
I think this is PAX Unplugged, yep, because there's no carpet on the floor. That's always my hint.
Oh, there you go. That's the telltale sign, yeah. so we were at all three conventions, the biggies this year. We did Gen Con and Origins and PAX Unplugged. And, you know, I think everyone was nervous going into con season this year. You know, were we going to have super spreader events? Were we going to see people who were, like, you know, bucking all the protocols and everything else? But I have to say, I was really, really pleased to find that people were super respectful, at least everyone that I happened to see. You know, there is no, like, half mask wearing. No. There is no unsafe behavior. People were being really great. And even being patient with, you know, things like, you know, sometimes it's hard to hear people through a mask, you know. And so we were all just really pleased with the environment that each of these cons provided and how people behaved in them. Of course, all the conventions were about half the size as normal. Mm-hmm. And so there was another concern, like, well, is it going to be worth it? Cons, if people don't know, are super expensive to go and actually do. Everything from the hotels to the meals, the space itself. I mean, you know, it's a big marketing investment to be at a con. And if sure. if you break even or make money, you know, yay. But so the question was, well, are we going to essentially really lose a lot of money? Because it's just going to be, you know, low numbers. Well, nothing could be farther from the truth. And I think this is true of a lot of companies that I spoke with, but we had record-breaking years at all three cons. And I'm talking about since I've been at those cons, it shattered every record previous with half the attendance. Now, I attribute that to a couple things. One, I think we actually had games to sell. Now, not every publisher right. was that lucky. You know, a lot of those games were either, you know, still stuck in, you know, logistics of shipping and that sort of thing, or got delayed even in production. But we had the Night Cage. We had a lot of our new offerings. We had enough stock of pretty much everything. And so that was terrific. Of course, we also had the Night Cage, which was a huge, huge seller for us. We did a very successful Kickstarter back, what, a year ago now. And so the games had just delivered for Gen Con, you know, into kind of like, you know, the anyone, you know, who hadn't backed, this is their first time to really kind of get a hold of one. And it has been, we just haven't been able to keep it in stock, quite honestly. Mm. Our first shipment sold out before it left port.
Gotcha.
So I reordered it immediately. And I checked with all my, you know, distributors, like, how many do we think we need? They're like, well, be conservative. I get it. It's COVID, but, you know, slow up. It's like, okay. So I printed the second one, and before it arrived, again, it was sold out. So we're now on our third printing, where we did like four times the number. We're doing like 12,000 copies now. And again, half of them are already sold and back ordered. So it's just doing gangbusters. And it's easy to see why, because it's a gorgeous game. It's a hugely thematic, dripping, you know, kind of a game. And it's just a very compelling gameplay as well. It was beautifully designed by Chris and Ross. And Chris Chan did all the illustrations, and they're just compelling to look at. You want to touch the pieces, and it puts you right into the theme of this world where you're plunged into complete darkness and trying to escape this this endless labyrinth. And the only thing you have is a candle to light your way. And that will only light one space away from where you are. And the cool thing about their game is that as you move, your light moves with you. So the board is created and destroyed as you move, because the only thing that exists is within your candlelight.
Right.
So if you move forward and the tiles behind you fade into the darkness, they're removed from the board. So if you go back, it's completely different now.
Yeah, and that's the part that got, like, I opened it and the production was obviously the first thing that I saw. The plastic tower, the pieces, even just the very starkness of the board, the black with pencil line white on it, you know. I'm not a horror person, so initially I was like, oh, this is horror, so I'll have to see. But it's really more about being lost than about horror, right?
Yes.
And it was that mechanism. I knew about the one space away. I kind of, you know, had some familiarity with the game, but it wasn't until I played it and realized it's you step forward, and then when you step back, the cave or whatever you're in, the pathway changes. And that was super interesting. So that was the part that really, that mechanism is what latched on for me as I was playing it.
And quite honestly, that was the mechanism that sold me on the game itself, because I'd never seen that before, and it absolutely makes you feel like you're lost in a labyrinth, because you never know what's around any corner. And of course, you're not in there alone. As you're looking for keys and trying to find a gate so you can turn them and get out together, it's a fully cooperative game, mind you. There are monsters in here that can, you know, attack and extinguish your light so you can only see just the space you're in and blunder forward into the darkness on your turn. But man, what a thematic existential horror game this is. And it just feels creepy when you play. And that's what I absolutely love about it.
Yeah, no, it was really neat. I was enjoying it. I got a chance, I played it solo, and I definitely got the sense of like, oh, I don't, and I know there are people who will love playing it solo. I am a give me people person.
Yes.
That's what I think I like about board games, is playing games with people. But I got this sense of like, ooh, I want to go play this with people. I want our minds to like clash on what we think is the best thing to do. Because if you were by yourself, you might run across somebody and be like, oh, here's a good plan. And then when you have to step into that darkness, you change your plan. Like, I don't think I want to follow what they said anymore. but the other great part is there are tiles that flip over and become pits. And you can jump in those pits. And you're basically like, it's like you fall into another section randomly somewhere else in the dungeon. So that was just a really neat part of like, oh, I think I'm stuck. Oh, I'll jump in this pit and try to get out.
Yeah, well, so what's interesting is there's only one way to escape the night cage, and it's not falling through a pit. No. So the board itself wraps side to side, top to bottom, and also three-dimensionally. So yeah, when you drop through a pit, on your next turn, after falling through a void, you fall back into the labyrinth along one of the access points that you fell into. So but of course, you don't know what you're going to fall on, and you could fall directly onto a monster in doing right. So there is a little bit of risk there, too.
Yeah, no, it was really fun. I definitely enjoyed that. The theme was neat. And then I see in the picture here, so I know for people listening on the podcast, pictures aren't as helpful, but you can check it out on the channel. But I see all these candles around. And I had friends, actually, Matt and Jen, you know, over at the library.
Sure.
Jen Bartlett. They were saying they had their neighbors over at one point and they played it by candlelight, and that really added to the experience. Were some of these candles included? Did you do something with a candle?
Well, for the Kickstarter, we had an all-in box that had LED candles, five of them that you could set around. And by the way, you know, it also helped people understand whether you had your candle lit or whether a monster had attacked you and you've gone lights out and you'd flick off your candle.
Right, right, right.
It's super, you know, all of these atmospheric things were really important to help really drive home the feeling of this game. In fact, we even created a 50-minute soundtrack for the game. We had it fully composed and orchestrated, and it's available for download through Spotify and Apple Music. In fact, later in the images here, I've got a QR code you can put on the page, and so people can actually go right there and listen to it. But it overlays the gameplay and kind of mirrors the types of things that are likely to happen at that given time during the game. So it's pretty neat.
Yeah, so and it's got all these tiles. You play with a different number of tiles. There's actually a board to track the tiles because tiles exit the game, so you can kind of see where you're at. And then there's an advanced mode. So for people who say, like, oh, it's a co-op, it's a puzzle, we'll figure our way through. Well, then there's another layer where you add bigger bad, and there's boss monsters, correct?
Yes. Yeah, there's both an advanced game.
Just the basic, yeah.
Yeah, both an advanced game and boss monsters. And so you can mix and match. You can add the boss monsters to the basic game and as well as to the advanced, all of which, you know, come with different rules and monsters. So, for example, in the advanced game, everyone needs a key to escape. And in the basic game, you're just going and finding key tiles, like, you know, places that actually you come upon a key. Mm-hmm. In the advanced game, you have to get those from within the bodies of these ethereal monsters. And there's only one safe way to access that, and that's from behind, where they can't attack you. So now you're kind of positioning those monsters where you think a teammate might be able to get that kind of vantage point. And if maybe you're the only one who needs a key and, you know, you're starting to run out of time, you might have to save up the nerve so you can charge into one of these monsters, take the hit, and grab your key. So there's lots of different wrinkles in the game that keep it interesting and exciting.
Nice, yeah. No, I want to get a few more plays in before I do kind of a full review. So I figured just chatting with you about it would be a good element. Like I said, I really want to play this with preferably four players, maybe even three, just to get all those minds around the table trying to work out that puzzle. I think that's a really a neat way to bring that element. I don't know. I think it even kind of has that Smirk and Dagger element because it's that, like, yes, I want to listen to you because it's a fully cooperative game, but I think I have a better idea, right?
Well, true. But I will say that this really is a full co-op. So if you're not working together, you are probably going to fall apart. In fact, I think, you know, the tiles that come off of the draw stack, they are randomized. So you know, there is that kind of random aspect to it. It makes it a little bit harder to QB the game because you don't have perfect information in that regard. Mm. But a lot of the strategy of the game is how you are positioning those tiles, how connected you're going to be, how close together you're going to be on the board, because the closer you are, the more susceptible you are to monster attacks, because multiple players getting connected to a monster can be a big problem. When they hit you, you're losing a lot of tiles from that stack, which is communal. On the other hand, the farther apart you are, especially towards the end of the game, you may not be able to connect on that one gate you all need to escape. And then you might run out of tiles and be cut off. So that balance and trying to figure out how to mitigate the risk, that is the strategy of the game. And to do that without teamwork is a nightmare.
for sure. Nice. Well, check out the Night Cage if you haven't seen it yet. Oh, here's some people playing as well. And then here's that. Ooh, I'll move our heads so people can get that QR code if they're watching on there. And I'll try to get a link to that up somewhere for people listening to the podcast as well. So they can get that. I'll put it in the show notes, link for the soundtrack that you can listen to while playing. But next up, I see The Spill, and I'm really excited to hear about this one because I heard a lot of good buzz, especially coming out of PAX Unplugged for this one. So tell us about The Spill.
Yeah, I think a lot of people got exposed to this game at PAX Unplugged in particular. People who have not been to PAX Unplugged, they have something called the First Look Room, which is a curated area that the organizers of the show put out to publishers and say, hey, give us the best of your best. Let us know what you think we should look at. Then they decide what actually gets featured. Mm-hmm. And so we put forward the Night Cage, and they said, absolutely, we are delighted to have the Night Cage. And they end up having two copies on two different tables for people to play throughout the convention. But at the same time, they're like, but could we also have the spill? And I was like, well, guys, it doesn't exist yet. It's just a prototype. No, we know that. But if you have at least two copies of that prototype, we'd love to feature it. And I happened to have had those. So nice. We had professionally made prototypes so that content creators could actually have it in hand to do their work. So we brought those out, and both our tables were filled nonstop at PAX Unplugged. For all 3 days, people could not get a seat, and they're waiting in line to play. It is another really interesting cooperative game. In this case, it's a game that is about an oil rig in trouble in the middle of the ocean. It's sprung a leak, it's gushing oil into the waters and threatening the sea life. So you are part of a team that's been dispatched to contain the spill, remove what oil you can, and save the marine life before a complete ecological disaster. What's kind of interesting about the game, and if for viewers, you can flip to the next slide there.
Yep.
The game features at its center, at the middle of the board, a really unique four-way dice tower. So as you drop oil dice down through the chute, the funnel at the top, it bounces down and then disperses into one of four quadrants at random. And then based on the number that's rolled in that quadrant, it'll go into the matching numbered sector, one through six, in that quadrant. So it very intuitively flows the oil randomly all across the board.
Right.
And what's kind of cool about that is it gives you a very narrative experience. You can see the danger develop as columns of oil dice start spilling forward away from the derrick towards the perimeter that you're trying to protect. You can see when oil dice land on top of sea life and contaminate them, and you flip the tile over, so now they've been oiled, and you see that the it's actually on the illustration, they're mucked. And you've only got until the end of that turn to at least get the oil out of that sector that shares the space, or they're going to go to sick bay. And this is a game where you win by not losing every single round. You're going to lose either because you have not controlled the oil and then you've got a column of three dice in six sectors around the board. It's just way too much oil. Or through problems with the marine life. If one of each type of the six types of marine life becomes contaminated in sick bay, that's a game loss. Or three of a single type, that's another way to lose the game. So you are basically fire jumping. Wherever the hottest problem is on the board, you spend your turn trying to get there to correct it. And every turn, more dice drop down the chute and create more problems. So you are planning together. You are trying to power these resource cards that you've chosen at the beginning of the game as a team. So you each get two. You get to choose one for the team. Everyone chooses one. So you've got four. And now you're going to power them up. And every time you save a certain number of animals or pull a number of oil out of the water, you get to an activation cube that you can use to now say, okay, this is the ability we want next. And do we want the weaker part, the part that we can do quicker, or do we want to invest over time in this bigger benefit? Of course, we didn't talk about how to win the game yet, and how you actually win the game is, well, first of all, there's a bag of 60 dice. And if all 60 dice drain out of the bag and you have not lost, you have eked out the narrowest of wins. But that is not the goal. The goal is actually to stop the flow. And so you've got nine win condition cards, and you'll kind of sort them and draw one at random at the beginning of the game. And it'll give you three mission goals. Things like in this particular quadrant, you can't have more than six oil dice at all. It's a protected habitat. So that may change over the course of the game. You start with it checked off, and then you might lose it and then regain it, that kind of thing. Or it might be you have to pull at least nine dice out of the waters and, you know, and remove them completely from the game. But you have to do all three of those mission goals without losing in order to win. and then you can stop the flow of dice. It's a gripping game. It's edge of your seat right to the very end. It'll remind people thematically of a game like Pandemic. Mm-hmm. But I think the rule set is probably a little bit more casual. It's a little bit more intuitive, and so a broader audience of gamers can sit and play it very quickly and, you know, dive in and get into it. But yeah, it's just got a great feel, and it takes some real planning. It's hard to play.
Yeah, I mean, this looks great. Just what you said, looking at the board here, I'm sorry that I haven't played it yet. Like, it looks really exciting. I can't wait.
I'll have to bring over to the shop.
Yeah, this is much more thematically in line with me too than something like The Night Cage. Although, like I said, I thought The Night Cage kind of transcended beyond like the horror theme to something that was much more in line with what I was looking to do. But this, yeah, I love this idea of like working together to clean up the oil spill, but more is coming. So you're trying to stop the flow, but also keep the animals. And then, yeah, like these goals that I actually like, the randomized or whatever you'd say, preset goals, because every oil spill would be different, right? As to what you're trying to contain and what you're trying to do and where the biggest risks, where the greatest harm would be. And that dice tower looks really neat. And then you're right. It's a very intuitive way to randomize like the events that are happening to you, but not in an overbearing way, right?
So,
very excited to play it.
Yeah, this is very definitely, it is kind of a perfect information game in the moment that you are playing.
Right.
But the randomization of where those dice drop and what problems they cause for your turn is, you know, that's kind of just the whim. So you are reacting throughout this game and trying your best to mitigate the risk. Where can we like alleviate things that we think could be problems? Mm. And having those discussions is also pretty intense. And, you know, I think because you've got these, you know, marine animals that are threatened, there's a tendency in this game to really, really focus on just saving the animals.
Right.
But I think first time players, and there's a strategy guide that even says this in the game. If you don't balance your effort, if you take your eye off of the ball of removing oil, you are going to get behind, and then it's going to create a devastation that you're just not going to be able to avert, and it'll catch up with you. So
nice. So what is the time frame on the release of this game?
So this is currently on press right now.
Okay.
So we're just about to get into Chinese New Year. It's probably not going to be completed until after they get back in March. So it's looking probably like May is a good guess, assuming shipping doesn't get even crazier again. But I think May is probably a good estimation. Certainly by Origins, we plan to have it available for sale.
Nice. Awesome. And this is where I forgot to do my homework, because I know we backed for the store, we backed the Kickstarter of The Night Cage, and we had those available. I did not bother to ask if we backed this one, so I don't actually know that. But that is when it would release for Kickstarter backers?
Oh, no. Kickstarter backers will hopefully get it sooner than that. Usually
okay,
a month
before. Okay, so then the retail release
before
would be May. Perfect. That's what I was going to try to parse out and figure out. And I'll try to let people know too, if this is one that we'll have some of the Kickstarter copies in, or we'll have the retail copies, where that'll be, as well. Cause I forgot to do my homework on that front. So
no
bad student in this case. Awesome. Well, oh, we got one more picture here. Oh, a couple.
Actually,
oh,
you got a bunch more pictures.
I missed a bunch. All right. I'm going to rifle through some of these just for people who are watching on there. Oh, wait, we got another game. I'm sorry.
Well, so we talked about the stuff that's kind of in the shoot, but
okay.
We've also got some stuff, if we've got time, that's kind of the future of what's coming this year.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So
I'll run these and you talk.
You got it. So the next game that we're going to be putting on Kickstarter is probably going to be mid-February, and it's a game called Behexed. which is a deck building game of Curse and Counter Curse. And this is a game where it's a very unconventional deck builder. A lot of deck builders are very much kind of a siloed play where you're trying to optimize your own engine. And you're trying to make sure it's more of a resource building game, a lot of deck builders. This is a highly interactive arcane combat game where you are slinging spells at each other and almost like Harry Potter and the Room of Requirement, like you're deflecting them back and forth, you know. So it's ping-ponging across the table and you are just trying to avoid getting hit. And what you're actually building your deck around are the types of interactions and strategies you want to employ. And those are based on kind of magical disciplines. The Witherer is all about forcing discards, which weaken your position, because if you can't deflect, you're going to get hit. So if you have fewer cards, you're more of a sitting target. You've got some that are all about life gain, or you've got an aggro that's going to try to, you know, knock down your willpower, which are, you know, essentially, you know, victory points and your health kind of all in one. The other thing is that a lot of deck builders, there's this thing where you buy victory points is kind of a major component of the game. Well, that's true in this game as well, but they're cursed victory points. All the cards in the deck that you can buy that are worth victory points are potentially dangerous to you.
Got it.
So it creates this really interesting dynamic of, well, do I want those victory points, or am I going to suffer too much with the effects as you know, either I add more chaos and it comes back to haunt me, or it has an effect that's going to stick with me and I'm constantly sacrificing, you know, because I have this particular card. The last thing is that it's a buy on the fly system. Very often in deck builders, when you buy a card, it goes to your discard and you hope your combos are eventually going to show up a few turns later. In this game, the cards you buy go immediately into your hand for immediate use. So sometimes if you're struggling with a situation, the solution might be in the conjuring wheel and you just have to discard cards to summon it. But that's the other thing. Every time you conjure a card, you're sacrificing cards from your hand in order to do it, to get those more powerful, more interesting cards. And that temporarily weakens your position. So it's a really interesting collection of mechanics where it's just a different way to experience a deck builder, where you're building the player interactions rather than a resource engine, and everything that you take on is potentially more risk, which is why the kind of the subhead of the game is that power has its price.
Right.
So that's kind of the idea of Behexed, and it plays 3 to 5 players in about an hour. It's just a fun, strategic and interesting take on something that's a much more kind of a interactive, almost kind of a take that game, but it's really more direct competition than it is take that per se. So
nice. Cool.
Yeah.
I'm trying to see what some of the other pictures, are these some of the characters from it?
Yep. Those are some of the mages. They're all asymmetric, so they have different starting decks. And again, they focus on, you know, some of the things that they do, whether it's card drawing, whether it's life gain, whether it's burning and optimizing cards in your deck. They all have something that they do. Ink on the top left here. Their cards shift with the environment. They can copy cards from either someone else is a played area or even the center conjuring area. So they're just kind of ethereal. But in any case, so yeah, lots of interesting ways to start the game. And there will be 10 different asymmetric mages as part of this game. And there'll be 4 different mastery packs. So you'll start with the initiative circle, which is kind of the base game. And then the game will instruct you when to go ahead and open the next mastery pack, gotcha. So that you can learn the game over time. And by the time you reach the 4th one, you are slinging multiple spells around the table. so that, you know, it's possible to duplicate spells so that multiple copies fly around, and it gets pretty crazy.
Nice. So here we can see some of the...
That's kind of the setup of the game. Yep, and that's at the center of the conjuring wheel, so there's always four cards potentially you can buy. And you can move on to the next thing here. This is just showing, you know, conjuring, you know, the cost and the fact that you have to sacrifice cards in your hand in order to pay for the things that you really want.
Right.
You can also even sacrifice your own willpower, which is, you know, again, some victory points that you might be sacrificing as well as defensive cards. So every card in your hand is both an attack and defensive, because if you can't play a card, you are hit by the hex, and that's when points are exchanged. So,
nice.
And yeah, so we're looking at February 15th. Don't hold me to it. I think I'm waiting to get confirmation that the prototypes will be here in time for content creators, so we can actually hold that date, but I need another few days, but I think that's when we're planning to do it. If not, it'll be like first week of March.
Yeah. So somewhere in, I guess that's still winter. I wanted to say spring, but quarter one of 2022.
Yep.
Nice. All right.
And
we're going on to another one. Is that
so? We got one other thing.
Great.
And that is, this is going right to retail, probably coming out in June. And it is a game called Boop.
Boop. So which I can't help. Did you watch Schitt's Creek?
Yeah.
Did you see the show? I can't help.
Yes.
But that's all I can think of. I'm sorry. As soon as you did that.
yes, indeed. So this is a terrific game. It's actually, it's a very thinky, abstract game. As cute as the cover looks, with this little, almost a Japanese style cat cartoon. It's cat-themed, and in the game, you are essentially placing cats on a bed and dislodging other cats off of the bed. And that's kind of
this. You brought this.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
I know this game. Okay.
Okay.
I'm ready.
So it's going to be absolutely adorable. We've got some pictures of like the playing pieces now that we've been working on. So there'll be adult cats and these kittens that go onto the bed. And the bed itself, by the way, use the bottom of the box as essentially, you know, the sides of the bed, and then there'll be an actual fabric comforter that goes on top, and that is the playing area. That's the bed where your kittens then go on and start. You place them on, and what's interesting about the game is you're trying to create a row of three kittens to graduate into an adult cat and a row of three adult cats to win the game. That sounds simple, except that every time you place a cat or a kitten on the bed, just like ripples in a pond, it pushes all the other cats one space away. And so they're going to fall off the bed, and it's like herding cats. Trying to get them together is very difficult, especially when someone else is strategically trying to bop your cats out of the way. So in any case, it's a really smart game with a really adorable hook. And so this, we're looking forward to bringing out, I think, by June or July. And again, it's going right to retail. So yeah, so those are a couple of things we got cooking in the pipeline.
Nice.
Awesome. as we move forward.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
For this episode of the podcast. And I'm used to doing so much talking, and it was great to just be able to listen and see some of the, it was really neat to be able to chat with you and to see the things both that are kind of in the works and are coming out and everything and whatnot. And hopefully we won't stay strangers, and 2022 will be a little less pandemic. I don't go for pandemic free and normal anymore, but a little less pandemic than before. And we can meet up for even local events and cons and things as well.
Amen to that. Yeah, absolutely. And we should actually try to get together and maybe even do a streaming of Behexed as we get closer, if you're interested.
That is what I was going to suggest as soon as we finish recording. So that would be great. Definitely. So just let people know where they can find Smirk and Dagger Games and Smirk and Laughter games. I want to make sure that I add both in and sure. any of those kind of things.
Yeah, you can find us at smirkanddagger.com. It's all spelled out. Of course, we're on Facebook, Smirk and Dagger. Any Google search is going to find you, all of our things.
Perfect. Nice. All right, well, that will bring this episode 178 to a close. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening to this episode. Thanks, Kurt, for being on with me here.
My pleasure.
And until next time, I'm the Brant, and I hope you step into the portal. Bye, everybody. Have a good one.